time is 3:07. Up next, it's hour two of the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Second hour of the Dr. Future Show. And this hour we have, besides all these wonderful people in the studio, besides Brian Harden, a noted filmmaker, and Bruce Erickson, agent provocateur, and Mrs. Future, who needs no introduction.
He's taking notes.
Besides those folks, we have Don Latton, an award-winning journalist, author of 6 books. The last 3, I believe, are the Harvard Psychedelic Club, How Timothy Leary, Andrew Weil, Ram Dass, and Houston Smith Killed the 50s and Ushered in a New Age for America. It went on to become a bestseller, won the 2010 California Book Award, Silver Medal for Nonfiction. And then he wrote a book called Distilled Spirits, Getting High, Then Sober, with a famous writer, a forgotten philosopher, and a hopeless drunk. Memoir of Aldous Huxley, philosopher Gerald Hurd, and Bill Wilson, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. Most recently, Don has written a book called Changing Our Minds, Psychedelic Sacraments and the New Psychotherapy, just published this spring of 2017, looking at the quiet revolution underway currently about how psychedelic drugs are making a comeback and how they can be used to treat depression, addiction, and other disease. After 50 years of being underground. Welcome, Don. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Doctor. It's great to be on the program.
Yeah, fascinated about your story arc from the Harvard Psychedelic Club to Distilled Spirits to Changing Our Minds.
Yeah, I didn't start out to write a trilogy, but I wound up doing that, I guess. I was the first 2 books are kind of on the history of this, you know, in the 50s, the early history, and then the 60s and 70s. But the new book, Changing Our Minds, is about, it's very now. It's very here and now. It's about stuff that's going on right now. A lot of really fascinating research, scientific research, and spiritual exploration.
So take us back. Well, why is it happening now? Is it because it was banned 50 years ago?
It actually wasn't exactly banned 50 years ago. What happened was there was a lot of research in the 1950s and 1960s, really into the early 70s. And what happened was, you know, the Nixon administration and the, you know, the war on some drugs and the backlash against the hippie counterculture and the new left and all the craziness of the 60s kind of got, the scientific and the medical research kind of got wrapped up in that. So the crackdown on recreational use, personal use, kind of extended over to the research. And it just became, it was possible to do research, you know, but it was the FDA and the various federal agencies made it very, very difficult to get permission to even do basic research, let alone, you know, human trials, clinical trials. So there was a period from 75 to about 95 when there was just nothing going on, absolutely nothing going on. And it started in 95 and it's been slowly building, but this year is a real crucial year in the clinical trials that are going on.
Yeah, what's going on now?
Well, there's two major actually, you know, one of the groups that sponsors this is called MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Right, they're right there in Santa Cruz. I mean, you guys are kind of a mecca for psychedelic research there. MAPS just had a big national convention in Oakland at the Oakland Convention Center. They had 3,000 people. They sold it out from around the world. I mean, scientists and therapists, doctors, research subjects, just ordinary people.
It was quite a confluence.
It was amazing. It was a great spirit. So there's just a lot of energy, a lot going on right now. The main thing MAPS is doing is they're working with MDMA, which people know sometimes as Molly or ecstasy.
Yeah, so more of an pathogen than a psychedelic, though, wouldn't
you
say?
Yeah, it's not technically a psychedelic, although I kind of use the word loosely because a psychedelic just means mind manifesting. But you're right, MDMA does have a different, it's a subtler effect. It's more an opening of the heart.
Right. Less mental and more heart.
And for that reason, it's great to use for therapists to use.
Sure.
For people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, because it allows the patients to talk about, you know, the trauma, the fearful events that happened, including a lot of Iraqi and Afghan war vets that are part of these clinical trials. So they're
able to reflect on it more easily than
yeah, they're that? Able to open up, reflect on it, and process the fearful memories and get through it. The thing to point out is that a lot of the research I'm writing about in Changing Our Minds, it's not taking psychedelics like most people take psychedelics, like, you know, at Burning Man or at a dance club or at a party.
It's not entertainment. It's research.
It's really therapy. It's work. Therapy, working on mood disorders, psychological problems. I mean, for the most part, there's some other research going on looking at comparing mystical states on meditation versus on another drug, psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms. So it's not all medical model, disease-oriented kind of clinical trials. There's some other interesting stuff going on, too. But the two compounds that they're mostly looking at in the clinical trials, and these are government-approved, you know, FDA, DEA-approved trials, are with MDMA, like I mentioned, and psilocybin.
MDMA and psilocybin.
Psilocybin is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms.
Yes, and that was some of the early experiments at Harvard, right? You talked about the Harvard Psychedelic Club.
Exactly.
Wasn't it psilocybin one of the first things they studied back in the 60s?
Yeah, Timothy Leary was a clinical psychologist at Harvard, and Richard Alpert went on to become the spiritual teacher Ram Dass later in the 60s. They started out doing research with graduate students, with seminary students, with prisoners, when they were using psilocybin.
Yeah, interesting. Listen, we have to go to a break. Could you hold on a sec, Don?
Sure.
Yeah, okay, we're talking to Don Latin on his new book, Changing Our Minds, Psychedelic Sacraments and the New Psychotherapy. This is the Dr. Future Show. We'll be back in a moment. Hey, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with Don Latin, award-winning journalist from San Francisco Chronicle. You were the religion editor for years, weren't you, Don?
I was, yeah. I was the religion writer, but broadly defined, though. You know, in San Francisco, we have a pretty eclectic spiritual scene.
Yeah.
What does religion mean in this day and age?
Yeah. I don't know if I'd want to do it in Atlanta or Dallas, where you write about Southern Baptists all the time, you know.
No, but did you write about the counterculture as some of the new religion?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I was really interested in that. You know, I started writing about this stuff way back in the 70s before it was a full-time beat. You know, but that was the so-called cult decade, you know, all the, like, the Hare Krishnas and the Moonies and Scientology and
really?
All that.
Really? So you wrote about all of them, huh?
Going. So I really started, actually, you know, I started writing about, remember People's Temple, Jonestown, that tragedy in Guyana
that
where 900 people died in the mass murder suicide,
yes.
One of the most infamous cult stories out there. That's how actually how I got started writing about that. That was a San Francisco group, People's Temple, and people forget that Jim Jones was, the Reverend Jim Jones, was considered a kind of progressive preacher before the whole thing imploded down there. So
did you
that's kind of how it started.
Interesting, wow. Did you find that any of these cults were using mind-altering drugs for programming people and creating strange religions from that, or was that a minority?
Well, I don't think that was going on so much. I mean, actually, some of these groups, like Scientology, they're very much anti-drug. I mean, even anti, like, mainstream psychiatric medicines.
Huh.
Most of them, the major new religious movements that I wrote about really weren't involved in that so much. I mean, of course, the whole kind of hippie counterculture is another thing, you know, but...
Yeah, well, it was more these things were from mind liberation than from mind control.
Right. Although, you know, there was a lot of nefarious research going on in the 50s into the 60s by the CIA and the U.S. Army into mind control. They were trying to use these drugs for mind control, but it didn't work very well.
No.
What they found.
There's a big difference.
They did some really horrific experiments. I mean, they would dose people. They wouldn't know they were, you know, high on LSD, and they'd think they were going crazy, and torturing people, interrogating people on psychedelic drugs. They did some horrible research sponsored by your government.
Well, I guess there were were seeing what the limits were and or how it could be useful in war scenarios.
They even did things like, could we spray it on enemy troops like a kind of weapon of mass distraction, you know, spraying LSD. And there was some wild research that went on.
Wow. Are they still doing research, or do you think that ended with MKUltra?
Well, not that we know of. I think they pretty much shut that down. It was actually after, a lot of that came out after Watergate. You know, there was the investigations into the, you know, kind of the secret government programs and all that. And a lot of that stuff that was going on in the 50s and 60s came to light in the 70s, and I don't think there's been too much going on. But who knows, you know?
Right. Was there any other much connection between our intelligence agencies and the counterculture?
Well, you know, it's interesting because some of the research that was being done for beneficial uses, you know, like using LSD to treat alcoholism or depression, some of this was funded by the CIA through these front groups. And the researchers didn't even know that there was a CIA connection. Yeah. They were actually just trying to figure out how these drugs work. These were new. I mean, LSD wasn't discovered till the 40s, you know.
That was Hoffman.
So they were, with Albert Hoffman, you know, during the war in Switzerland, Sandoz Lab. So this was new stuff in the 50s, and they were the CIA, and then also just, you know, the mainstream psychological community were trying to figure out, well, this is really powerful substance. You know, how can we use this? So there all kinds of research was going on, some of it funded by the CIA and others not, other research not, of course.
But. Right.
You know, so, Don, I thought in some of your books you were highlighting the story of the development of psychedelics and the psychology revolution, and it almost seemed like you were pitting the Skinnerists against the psychedelics in terms of the psychology, the psychological movement, you know?
Well, you know, one of the things that when they started working with LSD in the 50s and into the 60s, it was really part of this discovering the whole kind of biochemical basis for mental function and mood disorders and mental illness. So it was really, a lot of the early research helped them understand, like, the role that, for instance, it's serotonin, you know, the neurotransmitter serotonin plays in mental functioning and also in depression. Mm. So some of the early psychedelic research, if you trace it, it ultimately led to the development of some of these, you know, mainstream antidepressants now, these SSRIs that, you know, they hand out like, you know, candy to try to help people with depression. They're probably overprescribed. And you can really trace it back and see how the early psychedelic research helped them understand the biochemical basis of the brain as opposed to the Skinnerian or behaviorist ideas that were popular earlier.
Does this blur the line between modern psychotropic drugs, prescription drugs, and psychedelics, classic psychedelics?
Well, one of the interesting things is some of these research subjects, like, for instance, the Army vets with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, the people that they're using in these clinical trials, they're the worst cases. They're treatment resistant. They've tried all kinds of heavy legal drugs, antipsychotics, antidepressants, which didn't work and had horrible side effects for a lot of these guys. And they found that MDMA, ecstasy, actually works a lot better for certain people. And, of course, the whole idea behind this research is to get these drugs, specifically MDMA and psilocybin, rescheduled, decriminalized, so they can be used, not legalized, at least not initially, but to get these drugs decriminalized so therapists and doctors can use them, prescribe them, and use them in a therapeutic setting.
Then they will be competitive to these other drugs then, at that point.
Yeah. It's interesting because a lot of these drugs are different, though. It's not so much the drug that does the effect, it's the insight or the experience one has on the drug.
Yeah.
So it's not a kind of drug that you would take over and over again. So it's actually not a great medical of a business model for the pharmaceutical companies. They want a pill you have to take every day and keep buying.
Yes, you'll get better, but you'll have a spiritual experience along the way.
So the funny thing is there's kind of not an economic incentive in a way to develop these drugs because in some cases can work so well for people. People talk about having like 6 years of therapy in like one or two sessions. You hear those stories all the time.
Like, how is that possible exactly? You know, how can you do that much more therapy in such a, because you have better attention for processing?
You know, these substances are so powerful. These psychoactive substances are so powerful that they are able to lift people kind of out of their ego and out of their little stories and their obsessions and compulsions and take a whole new look at themselves and the way they think and the way they act. There'd be behavioral problems they're trying to address. So used carefully with therapy, they really can help people have a breakthrough that sometimes can take years with traditional like talk therapy.
Would you say you go to a deeper level of your core programming, perhaps?
Yeah, that's one way you could describe it, I would say. There's sort of a dissolving of boundaries, a transcendence of ego. Some of the researchers talk about people connecting with this kind of higher self or deeper self and getting understanding and insight that way.
Yeah, connection between things.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of it is it does sound like a spiritual or a religious experience. That's, you know, that was what I wrote about for many years, and that's kind of why I'm interested in this stuff.
Well, there have been a number of people put forth the idea that psychedelic experiences may have started religions. They're such a profound primal experience that they would have triggered off a spiritual family in the past, you know.
No, there's been lots of books and speculation about that. I'm not sure I, you know, buy into all of it, but, yeah. You know, there are groups, of course, like the Native American Church, which, you know, used and have for years used peyote in their rituals. So I also write about that in the book, by the way. I also have several chapters on the sacred plant medicines that are very popular now, including this tea that's from these two Amazonian
ayahuasca.
Plants. Ayahuasca, yeah. I have a couple chapters on that. So there's both a therapeutic renaissance and a spiritual renaissance. And some people are talking about a post-prohibition era, that this stuff is coming out of the underground, both the sacred plant medicines and the drugs like MDMA.
That's been used quite frequently. I've heard for marijuana. But are the psychedelics getting closer to being legalized?
They are. As a matter of fact, this is a crucial year. The two main clinical trials are entering their third and final phase this year. And if all goes according to plan, you know, that's a big if maybe, but they're talking about in maybe 4 or 5 years, these drugs could be rescheduled, taken off what they call Schedule 1, which is the most restrictive category, and used by doctors and therapists. So it's a very exciting time. There's a lot going on right now.
Now, Don, do you have something to say about sort of the counter-argument that people have, the original idea that drugs take people away from reality and thus they create human beings that are less functional in our day-to-day lives? What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think that can happen with people who take these drugs too much in a non-therapeutic setting. You know, we all have friends who took, I don't know if we all do, but I have friends who took too much acid, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, and some folks never quite came all the way back. But that's not what we're talking about here. See, we're talking about medical screening, preparatory therapy sessions, and then one or two sessions with a pair of therapists, and then...
So we're talking about people who are very educated and a set and setting that is very professional and controlled and not where kids are getting bad drugs on the street kind of thing.
Yeah, and I want to really stress that because I'm not recommending, you know, that people take these drugs at all. For one thing, they're illegal if you take them outside of these clinical trials. And you never know what you're getting when you buy. That's the other thing. You never know what you're getting or what dose you're getting when you buy drugs on the street. So it's a whole different thing. You really can't. It's like apples and oranges. You can't compare. And also, they're not using LSD, which is a more powerful drug, which can be used therapeutically and has been, but most of the research now involves MDMA and psilocybin, not LSD.
All right, we're going to go to a break right now. So
give us a call, 479-1080, and talk to Don Latin about his book. You have a chance after the break.
Okay, and CBS News is coming up, then we'll be back. Dr. Future Show on KSEO.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with Don Latin in his latest book, Changing Our Minds, about a quiet revolution on understanding how psychedelic drugs work and how they can be used to treat depression, addiction, and other diseases. So welcome back, Don. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And I believe we have a caller, Mrs. Future.
We sure do.
All right. Bring on Billy.
Welcome to the show, Billy.
Hi, kids. Another great show.
Thank you.
I can't believe you're not syndicated, really. We got to do that. And by the way, Comey has been fired by Trump. But
yeah, it's all over the news.
That.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, my wife has been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and so we think it's time for us to do a mind meld, a wipe. So we're thinking about microdosing with LSD. What can your guest tell me about that?
Well, if you microdose, it won't be a mind melt, because the whole thing about the whole thing about microdosing is it's supposed to be a tiny dose that's sub-perceptual. So there's kind of two different things there going on. I do write about microdosing in the book. There's a researcher in Menlo Park. He goes all the way back to the 60s, but he's still around, Jim Fadiman, who has written a book on microdosing. And that's been getting a lot of attention. It's very popular, supposedly, in Silicon Valley, you know.
And he writes here in Santa Cruz.
As a way to increase, like, sort of productivity, in a sense, which is kind of funny. You know, mental functioning and creativity and all
Valley.
That. Yeah, exactly. But I mean, in the 60s, we took psychedelics to work less, not more. But, you know, it's a different era now. So.
Well, we just figured we could use a real attitude change at this point, just to freshen up after all these years. And,
yeah, well, you know, microdosing could work, but also, you know, the research there is research going on with psilocybin, giving psilocybin to cancer patients, and there is a whole new round of clinical trials that are actually starting, and there may be some going on in the Bay Area, possibly at UCSF. They're just setting this up right now. The organization sponsoring that is called HEFTER. Research
Hefter.
Institute.
H-E-F-T-E-R?
H-E-F-F-H-E-F-F-T-E-R.
Okay.
They're in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You can Google them. You'll find them. Yeah, there's two main tracks. We talked before about MDMA and PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, but the other research is with cancer patients, and they're not treating the cancer. They're treating depression, anxiety, and kind of the existential distress that people can have, you know, facing death. And there's even some research, you know, with couples doing this together, because, you know, it's the other member of the couple, you know, is dealing with this as well.
Absolutely.
So,
it happens to both of you.
Yeah. So, yeah, you might want to check that out.
Hmm. Great. Thanks a lot. It's very interesting.
Sure. Right.
Yeah, well, thank you, Billy.
Right.
Thanks.
Good.
Huh. So, psilocybin, what is the connection between psilocybin and cancer, the emotional state of dealing with the cancer?
They're not dealing with the cancer per se. They're dealing with the psychological effects from a diagnosis, from a life-threatened diagnosis. You know, like, I think there's something like 30-40% of people who get a diagnosis, you know, have severe depression, which can be, in some ways, worse than the cancer. I mean, you can be treated for the cancer. Oftentimes, you can be cured of cancer, but there's that psychological issue. So that's what they're dealing with, not the cancer itself.
Yeah, deeper thing than the placebo effect. A state of mind actually might, and psilocybin also can facilitate deeper spiritual awareness too in people. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, some people kind of call it even a carefully guided psilocybin journey, which is can be a very powerful psychedelic journey, like with LSD. It can almost be, in a way, kind of a dress rehearsal for death. You can kind of experience going out of your body and a kind of a mystical state. And it can actually, people talk about being less afraid of death once they go through this journey. Getting new, basically being able to live again. You know,
yeah.
I mean, a lot of these are not necessarily people on their deathbed. They might be someone who, you know, will live another 10, 15 years, you know, but it's learning how to live again with the cancer diagnosis, diagnosis. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. We have another caller, Mrs. Fincher?
Yes, we do. Let's say hello to Judith. Hi, Judith. Welcome to the Dr. Future Show.
Great to be in Sanity Cruise with y'all.
Yes.
What a great show.
Thank you.
I'm calling to say that LSD changed my life. I will never, never be unloyal to it. It has taken its toll on my relationships with my family and in life, because, you know, it has the negative side. But I really would wish it wouldn't take 5 years for it to be legal, because I think as intelligent survivors of this age, and I would just like to self-medicate, but, you know, I'm not calling to ask for it. But anyway, thank you for writing this book, and there's a beautiful review, and I'm going to order it right now. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Judith.
Yeah, appreciate it, Judith.
And don't forget to tell everybody that the DNA was discovered by Francis Crick. On LSD, wasn't it?
Well, that does bring up the whole idea of creativity and psychedelics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Steve Jobs has said that his psychedelic experiences kind of helped him develop some of his ideas. The guy who invented the mouse, the computer mouse, you know.
Mm-hmm. Doug Engelbart.
Engelbart, he said that an LSD trip kind of helped him to have a kind of a creative breakthrough.
You have the fellow who discovered LSD, Albert Hofmann, saying that a search for LSD discovered another related drug that helped him. He attributed that to having a clear mind and living to be 100 years old.
Yeah. I mean, he actually microdosed himself. I mean, for years.
Yeah.
The caller is interesting. You know, she's talking about this being legal in 5 years. Well, that's not probably going to happen. There's a difference between legalizing and decriminalization for medical reasons.
Like, if we get a psychedelic coffee drink or something like that, it'll be
some people are saying that this could be, it's kind of like the medical, it's like marijuana. You know, first you had medical marijuana, and then people realized, well, this is really not that dangerous, and then it led to full legalization like we had last year in California. Mm-hmm. Some people say, no, that's, these drugs are, you know, can be psychologically dangerous or damaging if not used properly. So people have a different opinion about whether they should be completely legalized or not. Some people say it's an issue of cognitive freedom. You know, we should have the right to explore our own minds, and the government shouldn't be telling us whether we can or cannot do that.
And certainly in this part of the country.
Yeah. So.
Now, can you have a psychedelic experience on cannabis?
You know, that's the funny thing. Some of this cannabis now is in some ways so strong that it's really
a
psychedelic experience.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. I mean, especially compared to like MDMA, which is in some ways milder in terms of the psychoactive effect, or even a low-ish dose of psilocybin. It all depends on the dose, you know. But yeah, the cannabis can be very psychedelic.
I mean.
Yeah, I want you to give us that little poem when Huxley and and Osmond,
the origins of the psychedelic term.
In the 1950s, the word psychedelic had not been coined yet. They called these drugs psychomimetics, meaning they mimic psychosis, which they can do. But Huxley saw that, well, there's also a more positive side of this, so can we have a more neutral word? And he had a correspondence with Dr. Humphrey Osmond, who was the Canadian researcher who turned Huxley on to mescaline in 1953, which led him to write The Doors of Perception, a very influential book. Anyway, after that, they were trying to come up with a new word, and Humphrey Osmond, they would write little poems to see how they could, you know, use the word, and they decided on psychedelic after Osmond came up with, "To fathom hell or soar angelic, take a pinch of psychedelic." Fathom hell or soar angelic, take a pinch of psychedelic, and they decide, okay, that's the word. And one of Huxley's points was that these drugs are kind of a double-edged sword. You can go to heaven and you can experience hell. Anyone who's had a difficult LSD trip can testify to that, myself included.
So would you say that that's why they're not addictive? Because you never know what could happen. You could go either way.
They're certainly not addictive, especially compared to something like tobacco or alcohol or cocaine or heroin. Those are addictive drugs, can be addictive drugs. Some people think that MDMA, that's not addictive, but it can be abused, you know, because it is kind of a euphoriant and it is a stimulant. I mean, the A in MDMA is amphetamine. But the classic hallucinogens, so-called hallucinogens, like LSD or psilocybin or mescaline, there's no way you can really say they're addictive.
Yeah, it doesn't quite fit the description of your experience.
Not something you want to do every day.
Yeah, right, no. It gives you a lot to think about.
Yeah, exactly. I need a few years to process after I do something.
Yeah, exactly. Do you see more people coming out of the psychedelic closet these days? More people willing to talk about their experiences?
They are. That's really an interesting thing that's going on right now.
Can we hold that because we got to go?
Sure.
We have a minute.
I didn't want to interrupt. I just wanted you to know we're getting.
Yeah, okay. No, there is. I mean, a lot of these researchers. You know, these are people who these are full professors at prestigious medical institutions like UCLA or Johns Hopkins or NYU. Some are comfortable coming out of the closet and talking about their own experiences. Others aren't. So
they have to tenure or not. I guess.
there are these two groups I mentioned, Hefter and MAPS. Mm. MAPS tends to be more kind of out there on the legalization kind of crusade, whereas Hefter is more stick to the science. They're a little more cautious, you know, and conservative. So part of it is that. I kind of come out of the psychedelic closet in this book, in a way. I mean, I decided that as a participant observer or journalist, it was important for me to experience these drugs in the context I'm writing about them. So I did
very
that.
Very interesting. You know? Okay, well, good. Let's talk about that after the break. How you tie in your personal experiences with what's unfolding here.
It seems to me like you're emulating the thought process with Tim Leary that you wrote about, right?
So in a way, yeah.
All right, folks, we'll be right back with the Dr. Future Show and our guest, Don Lattin. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Talking to Don Lattin about his new book on changing our minds and modern-day psychedelics and therapy. And we got a question, Don, from Bruce out in the audience who is wondering if you heard of the film called Crazy Wise. Crazy Wise. Does that sound
Crazy Wise?
W-I-Z-E? S-S-E?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
Yes, it's about...
This is Bruce here.
It's about the indigenous experience. We just showed that down in Santa Barbara. It was a huge hit. They showed it at several places about the comparison about contemporary studies in use in various therapies for recovery versus indigenous. And they often used psychedelics in the indigenous tradition to where people had visions and different things like this. The documentary was absolutely excellent. It was
I'll check it out. It sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
Okay, Crazy Wise. Well, thank you, Bruce. Appreciate that. Now, Don, you were going to say that some of your, I guess you could say your preparation for doing this book was to not just write about it, to actually have an experience of these substances.
Yeah, I think to write about it intelligently, you have to experience these states of consciousness. And of course, you know, I'm a baby boomer. I came of age in the 60s and 70s. So, you know, I had tried a lot of these
More recreational
drugs, you know, back in the day. But it's important to do it in the context that I'm writing about, which is either a therapeutic context or a spiritual context. So, yeah. And I wound up, actually, I didn't start out with this intention, but I wound up finding an alternative treatment for my own depression through doing this work.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I was in Brazil, and I wanted to try ayahuasca in Brazil, and I was on antidepressants, just regular antidepressants. Mm-hmm. And they say you should actually get off them before trying ayahuasca because there can be something called a serotonin surge. It's slightly dangerous. So I wanted to get off them anyway, so I got off them to do that. And then I didn't want to really go back on, and so I explored some other options, and I wound up writing about and discovering this drug, ketamine, which is an interesting drug.
Yeah, that's supposed to be used for antidepression, too.
There's a lot of research with depression. It's a dissociative anesthetic, but it's not psychedelic per se, but it has psychedelic properties. And it's really, in a sense, the only legal psychedelic. And so a doctor can prescribe this.
Ketamine
for, and a lot of doctors are prescribing it for depression. Kaiser is using it for depression. That's how mainstream it's gotten. So I read about this at the end of Changing Our Minds, that how I used a combination of ayahuasca at several spiritual groups, retreat centers, and then ketamine to basically, so I basically have...
So that was your
alternative. Yeah, and then I tried some other substances, like there's this 5-MeO-DMT, which is from a toad, from a Sonoran Desert
toad. Short experience, right?
It's a very intense, very, very intense. I mean, it's like being strapped to a rocket and shot through a kaleidoscope and into this state of pure energy. It's really intense. Huh. And I tried that at a clinic in Mexico where it's legal. It's not legal here. It was actually an ibogaine. That's another drug I read about, ibogaine, which is something that's used to treat heroin and opiate addiction, which is a huge problem in this country right now.
I did not
try the ibogaine. They also used 5-MeO-DMT, the toad medicine, at this retreat center in Mexico that I visited. So I read about that in the book, too.
Oh, interesting. So maybe you found for your own depression the combination of ayahuasca with ketamine seemed to work
the ketamine,
the best.
Yeah. I mean, the ketamine is something that you can do. I mean, I've, like, once a week in a controlled kind of... It's really like a meditation for me. It has been helpful for my depression, and it's a psychoactive experience. You know, you are out there for about 40 minutes.
Well, I've heard some people feel like, I heard some people feel like they're in what we might consider other worlds, virtual worlds on ketamine, where there's some.
Yeah, it all depends on the, you have to be careful with the dose, you know, it all depends on the dose. But for me, you know, not just ketamine, but a lot of these medicines, they're sort of like meaning generated. They generate meaning. They remind you of how things in your life fit together and have meaning. And that's kind of the opposite of depression. You know, for me at least, when I'm in a depressed state, it's like, you know, why, you know, it's forgetting how everything fits together, not having the gratitude and that you have for people in your life. So used carefully, these drugs can reinstill that feeling. At least they have for me.
So they bring back more appreciation for what is?
Yeah, you know, awe, wonder, gratitude, meaning, connection. People talk about connection. That's, you hear that word a lot. Remembering, retrieving. And again, working with a therapist is important, and doing this in a safe, secure, controlled setting is very important.
If an audience was interested in this, how would they go about doing this? Is there a therapist?
Well, ketamine, there's lots of ketamine clinics out there. It's very popular now, and like I said, it's not a Schedule I drug, so doctors can, it's called an off-label prescription. So there are clinics, there's even the ketamine lozenges, which you can use at home under a doctor's supervision.
Really?
You get it from a compounding pharmacy. Yeah, no, it's completely legal. Yeah. And I write about this at the end of the book, that it's kind of cutting edge stuff, but some therapists think it's not a good idea to do it on your own at home. Others think that if you do preparation with a doctor and therapist and you can handle it, you can handle it, you know.
So I have a question for you. It seems to me like you've done a lot of research on the biochemistry aspect of the consciousness, and I'm just curious how much you rely on the biochemistry and how much you rely on the contents of your mind and your conversation and your consciousness when you're trying to do therapy with this.
Well, it's all about the content of my mind and reflecting. It is biochemical, but that's just kind of what it is.
Well, the reason I bring it up is because so many people really are talking about addiction as something where you pop a pill and it solves the problem for you. And I really want this show to point out that it is not
you have to be willing to do the work.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
It's not. You have to do the work. And especially with something like psilocybin or ayahuasca, the preparation and the integration, preparation before and the integration after, is very important. Ketamine is a little different. I mean, ketamine, there is a biochemical. They're just really figuring it out now, but it affects the glutamate system, and there's a lot of research showing that it's a very effective antidepressant. But at the same time, it does have this kind of a psychedelic property of kind of transcending your ego, kind of lifting out of your body in a sense. It's a really interesting substance. It's also, you know, it can be addictive. It's one of the so-called date rape drugs. You know, it has a whole other reputation as a party drug, and all these drugs do. It's all about how you
set
use
and
it,
setting,
what your intention
as they say.
Is. It's
yeah.
set and setting, intention, mm-hmm. it's dose, it's the care and caution you bring into it. It's like anything. Alcohol can be enjoyed by millions of people, and it destroys many people's lives. It's
you go both
tobacco,
ways.
You know?
So what's been the most profound experience you've had in exploring these realms?
Well, in some ways, the most powerful was the toad medicine, the 5-MeO-DMT. That was so powerful, it was hard to bring anything back. It was so fast and intense. So I'd say, you know, I had some real insight down in Brazil
with ayahuasca.
I did several all-night sessions with ayahuasca, which helped me understand some issues I was trying to deal with. At the very end, I write about a psilocybin mushroom session I have with an underground therapist. You know, there's these clinical trials which are legal and above ground. There's a whole underground psychedelic therapy scene where you can find a therapist to work with you. It's not legal, so it's underground.
Right.
I sought out one of those, like sort of a medicine woman or a therapist, and worked with her with some issues that I was dealing with. I had some four or five close friends of mine have died in the last 5 years, and I have a lot of grief and around that and sadness around that, and I worked through some of that stuff with this therapist with mushrooms. And it was completely different way of taking mushrooms than I would normally have done that back in the day, where you're at the beach, you're having fun, you know. And it's a completely different experience when you do it with a therapist with a particular intention. It's really interesting how it works that way.
Do you think it would be good for our culture to have all these things legalized in the near soon?
Yeah, therapy
salons. I think it would be good, but I think it should be done. I think there should be like therapy centers, retreat centers, and a beautiful, like, you know, something like Esalen, you know, that kind of a setting. Mm.
So lots of Esalens for people to experience these things
Do this, and you know, with supervision and, like I say, preparation and integration. And I think that's coming. I really do. I think if that may be 10 years down the road, who knows?
Well, it's interesting, the story you tell in your book about how the graduate students who wanted to be in the Tim Leary research going on, since he was encouraging people to participate as takers as well as watchers in the research, and how not everybody who came and asked was actually suitable for doing that, right?
Yeah, well, Leary's an interesting case. It's like ancient history now in some ways. He sort of left science in a way. I mean, he really turned this into, you know, he was kicked out of Harvard, but he was ready to go anyway.
Oh,
he was really on a social crusade.
Thanks, Don.
Yeah, sure.
We got to leap. Thank you. Thank you for being on the show. We're talking to Don Lattin on Changing Our Minds, Psychedelic Sacraments, and the New Psychotherapy. Any final thought, Don, before we take off?
I just, if people want more information, they can go to my website, which is donlattin.com. There's some events coming up. They can find those there if they want to come see me at a bookstore or an event. That would be great.
Good. She'll be speaking. You're doing a speaking tour.
Yeah, I'm doing something on May 30th at California Institute of Integral Studies. So
okay, great.
That's coming up, yeah.
And how can people reach you?
DonLattin.com is the best way, or Don@DonLattin.com.
Thanks a lot, everybody. Great show.
Thank you, Don.
Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Okay.
KCO Santa Cruz.